You're very welcome to Saturday with Brian Dowling, and you can send us your views on any of the topics we cover. Here's how you can get in touch. You can text us on 51551. Our email address is saturday@rte.ie, and our Twitter address is @SaturdayRTE. Joining us now from our Cork studio, Fine Gael TD and Chairman of the Oireachtas Health Committee, Gerry Buttimer, Dr. Ray Wally, Chairman of the GP Committee of the Irish Medical Organisation, Roisin Shorthall, a former minister at the Department of Health and now an independent backbench TD, and community activist Mick Rafferty. Later, we'll also be joined by Vincent Boland of the Financial Times and economist Dr. Konstantin Gurdjieff, and Fianna Fáil's finance spokesman Michael McGrath will also be joining us. Now, I think in the immediate aftermath of the budget, it looked as though the government had avoided any major political pitfalls. But over recent days, the medical cards controversy has deepened. Yesterday, Liveline featured a number of distressing cases. Lydia Nolan O'Connor spoke of her 8-year-old daughter, Erin.
This morning, my husband rang me from home in Mullingar and told me about the medical card, that Erin's medical card and my medical card had been stopped. I actually rang 2 weeks ago because, you know, when you get the renewal letter out,
yeah,
and I hadn't heard anything. And they were like, oh, no, you should have no problem. I said, like, Erin's got worse. She's regressed in the last year and stuff. And she said, no problem. And there should be no problem with you. Just because I wanted to check because we're in hospital for so long, because you could imagine the bills. Like, not having even started and what it cost.
And what will the loss of the medical card for Erin, what difference will that make?
Well, Joe, she's on 45 syringes of medication a day. She's on 18 different boxes of tablets. For instance, her Zonegran, that's one tablet, but that costs €70 a box. She's on Oromorph patches, and morphine patches, and she's on Oromorph orally as well. She's in chronic pain under palliative care, and they're trying to get her comfortable. There is no way in hell I can leave this hospital. It would cost hundreds a week on medication.
The medical card has gone up by another euro per item. Me personally, I suffer from cystic fibrosis and I'm in hospital right now. It's going to go from €18 per month to €30 per month. My mother's on 7 medications. That's €10.50 up to €17.50.
At the moment, I'm paying €19 for drugs. I'm on morphine patches for pain and everything. And I really have to have my medication. And I'm on tablets for my heart, the diabetes, as you can imagine. And I heard then that it was going from £1 a night and up to £2.50, I think it is.
About, yeah.
And I definitely, I nearly have to say at this stage, I'm not going to take anything from my condition and just let myself collapse and be taken into hospital.
Dr. Ray Wally, you're chairman of the IMO GP committee. What's your reaction to that? Are these cases isolated cases, or are you picking up a pattern among colleagues?
We are concerned in regard to the prescription issues there that are being brought up, because it is already showing non-compliance. The HSE are aware of this because they get good solid data from pharmacists in regard to drugs which are not picked up in pharmacies. There are other issues in regard to this, though. It is actually going to cost the state more money to provide for this medication on the drug payment scheme than it will if the actual medical card is taken away. Because the state gets medication at cost from the pharmaceutical companies, whereas there is a markup from the pharmaceutical companies when it is done on the drug payment scheme. So there is no cost-benefit analysis on this, because if there was a cost-benefit analysis, it is a no-brainer.
And looking at the wider issue, because one of the issues over the past week has been this whole issue about discretionary medical cards and the latitude that might apply. A lot of people are saying that the criteria that are being applied, there are some, I think two of the criteria have been removed. But what's your experience? Are you getting patients coming into, since the announcement, for instance, in the budget that 35,000 people of the over 70s will be taken out of the medical card pool and given GP-only cards?
Well, since the budget, Wednesday, Thursday and Friday, GPs have been inundated with patients who had no clinical health problem, with distress, wondering if their medical card is going to be taken away. The majority of those were elderly people, but many of them were not. I accept that what the Taoiseach says is the criteria has not changed. But something has changed, because we're getting more distressed patients worrying about the card. If the criteria hasn't changed, certainly the interpretation or the application of the criteria has changed.
Gerry Buttimer in Cork, you chair the Oireachtas Health Committee. Just from your experience both on the ground in Cork and talking to colleagues, is the medical cards issue now becoming a political nightmare for the government?
Good afternoon, Brian. And can I just first of all acknowledge that what's happened to Lydia and people like her shouldn't be happening, and that those who need medical care and access to medical treatment should be given. The Taoiseach and the Minister and Tony O'Brien were before our committee on Thursday, and the criteria hasn't changed. But what has changed, as we've moved to a one central application source for medical cards, and there has been, unfortunately, glaring cracks in that, and that some people have fallen through, and the trauma and the stress of people like Lydia and her daughter, that shouldn't be happening. And the job now of the HSE is to communicate more clearly, more humanely, more sensibly and more sensitively to the people who are in need of the medical card and medical card treatment.
But it is happening, Gerry. I mean, these cases are coming forward. And the point is it becoming a serious political difficulty for the government?
Well, I don't want to look at it as a political difficulty. What I want to look at it from the point of view is from the people who require access to medical care and who require a GP card or a medical card. And what I would say is that we do need to have a very clear communication strategy, that people need to be informed and told and helped and educated in filling out the form and resubmitting their application. And that has to be done sensibly, sensitively and in a humanely way, because this is about a person requiring medical care treatment. And nobody, Brian, can defend what happened to that lady in the clip in Joe Duff yesterday or for other people who walk into offices. But there is an obligation on all of us to work to make sure that people who require medical care receive it.
As you know, in the budget, the minister announced the intention to seek savings of up to €113 million from a review of medical card eligibility. And at your own committee the other day, your colleague, the Minister for Health, Dr. James Riley, said, "I am, frankly speaking, concerned about what can be achieved here." If he seems doubtful about whether these savings can be effective, where does that leave the government?
Well, it is, to quote the minister, challenging. The HSE service plan will be submitted to government. But let's put things in context. And I think it's time that we had a real debate about healthcare in our country, and we just can't funk this debate any longer. There are people, Brian, in the past who received medical cards who were way over the threshold, 200, 400% over the threshold, and they still have them. So let's have a debate. Who is eligible for medical card? The 1970 Health Card Act states it's based, you're assessed on means of income. So, you know, let's have a debate about who deserves to have a medical card. And I would make the point to you in this programme and to other people who come into my office every day, those who require access to healthcare and who fulfil the criteria should receive it automatically. Those who were 200, 400% over the limit should not get one. But that doesn't mean that we have to, you know, abandon all of the reform process. This government is moving towards universal healthcare. It starts with the GP for under fives, but there's a wider debate that has to be had in terms of how we can present a reform model of healthcare. And I take Ray's comments, and I agree with some of what he said regarding the whole issue of prescriptions and so on. But let's have an honest debate about the whole issue around medical cards. Those people who require a medical card should get it. Those who are over the threshold by a significant amount, then there's a question mark. Do you go back to the old patronage system, or do you move away to a model of healthcare that's based upon the need of the patient, or do we do it on political patronage?
Roisin Shorthall, you are a former minister, obviously, in the Department of Health. Is one of the key issues here the fact that the system changed in 2011 and it now moved to a more centralised system? And is that simply a more, if you like, numerical-based system as distinct from previously, where there might have been more input from community workers, from doctors? Is that part of the difficulty, what's happening?
That is a factor, there's no doubt about that. And the centralising of the medical card system resulted in, I suppose, a more standard kind of approach to looking at the criteria and a standardised assessment of applications. But I believe it's a complete misrepresentation of the situation to suggest that some of these very, very tragic and hard cases that we heard about earlier on are somehow isolated cases. They're not. We're all coming across this in our constituencies. You know, Joe Duffy is full of it every day of the week on the radio. The fact of the matter is that you can't make substantial budget cuts in the health budget and target savings in the medical card area without that having serious implications for people's health and for their income. You know, the reality is that if you put the squeeze on people's medical cards, well, then you're denying people an access to basic health care. And more people, it would seem, are now going to be denied that basic access, either through additional costs for GP services, for community services and for medicines. You know, the government has targeted savings of €149 million this year in the medical card area. They're talking about €113 million from what they call probity measures. That means putting the squeeze on people who already have medical cards, people who might have had medical cards for the last 10 years with a chronic illness, and now they're going to be denied medical cards. It also targets €25 million from the over 70s and a further €11 million for people who are unemployed and who return to work in an effort to remove the poverty trap. There was an arrangement where people would retain a medical card for 3 years.
It would seem, though,
that is going now too.
It would seem, though, that one of the factors which is driving this review, is that the Controller and Auditor General's report for financial spending in 2012, which was just issued a few weeks ago, dealt with the issue of eligibility of medical cards. And there were two points, I think, that are quite striking. The HSE conducted a review, a full review of 109,000 cases where renewals came up for medical cards. And in that examination, they found that there was 19,000 people didn't respond, 9,000 were not eligible. They then conducted a separate, more targeted review, and I think Ray might say something just in a second again, where they looked at those medical cards up for renewal where patients had no activity on their medical card over the previous year, and I think they looked at 40,000 cases. Of that, 61% of them confirmed their place of residence. The remainder, which was over 15,500 people, did not reply and had eligibility removed. And the CNAG's report says that these individuals had not reapplied or been granted a medical card as of May 2013. That would suggest that there is some scope for savings. Maybe not 113 million, but there is some scope there.
OK, I want to say a couple of things about that. The first thing is in relation to eligibility for a medical card. The income limits were set in October 2005. 8 years ago, and haven't changed at all since then. So we're now in a situation where the basic social welfare payment that people receive, whether it's pensioners or people who are unemployed, is actually above the income limit for a medical card. So, you know, it's literally people with no income at all who would qualify under the criteria that are set down. So the income limits are exceptionally low to start with. And that's denying a lot of people who are very poor access to a medical card. But the point that you raise in relation to the review that was carried out, that review suggested that there's potential overspending in this area. It was a review that was done over a very short period of time. PwC carried it out. They issued a very clear disclaimer saying this is only a rough calculation and it was a desktop exercise and much more detailed work needs to be done. But notwithstanding that, the HSE did then proceed to do the work that you're talking about there and has removed a number of deadweight medical cards in the system. So there isn't anything like the potential that suggested to be saved.
Mitch Rafferty.
The medical card issue and the prescription issue is just an example of what is this budget that's an attack on the weak, the taking vast amounts of resources out of the income of and services of people who are already poor. And even the contradiction of giving under fives free medical without means testing, and then taking the medical card off certain categories of people. There's an article today in the Inno, Dr. Donald Punch. Do you know Dr. Donald Punch? He says he's Secretary of the General Association of General Practitioners. But he just says the funding, to fund the under-five thing, which is grossly underestimated, is to come from stopping discretionary medical cards, which we've heard, taking cards from the over-70s and increasing the fee for medical card prescriptions. And this is what he says, which I think is interesting. This is tantamount to robbing unhealthy Peter to pay healthy Paul. And I think that's what's happening in the system, that there's no extra money going in. It's been juggled around. And the juggling is coming down against those most in need of health intervention.
Dr. Ray Wally, I want to come back as well to Jerry Buttimer. Ray.
A lot of this is based on the accuracy of the data they're getting. In the PwC report, they looked at 50 cases. The big thing that stands out in the report is the disclaimer. They basically indicate you cannot base anything on the basis of that. The CNAG also said on the same report, you couldn't base any provision of what they're doing on this.
No, you couldn't make an accurate forecast, but it does suggest that there is some potential.
Sure, but it also, the range
has been exhausted.
And the range was 60 to 200, and of course 113 is smack in the middle. What they count as activity on a card is when somebody presents with a prescription. Quite a high proportion of patients are attending GPs, and they don't count that as activity. Activity, I'm afraid their assessment of activity is not appropriate. In regard to they have equally not done the cost-benefit analysis in regard to the prescribing. many of the elderly people are on many medications. And those medications are, again, going to cost a lot more money on the drug payment scheme as opposed to when you get it on the medical card. If you personally, I think this should be put out an independent cost-benefit analysis. The report should be looked at. I cannot see how they're going to make these cuts. These people are not the exceptions. They are all over the place. The people, the exceptions are Ian Joe Duffy.
Gerry Buttimer in Cork. Is the target of €113 million on the review, the probity review, is that simply arbitrary?
Well, it's a big ask, Brian. There's no doubt about that. And it's got to do with a whole compendium of those in excess of the income level. It's got to do with the people who administer the scheme, i.e. the doctors, dentists, pharmacists, as the Minister made comment in the committee on Thursday. But the goal of the Minister and the Department and the HSE is not to cut service or the quality of services, to cut the cost of service. And there is a need for probity. But in saying that, we are spending $13.26 billion in health again this year. And I would make the point, can we really justify a medical card being given to somebody who is 200% over the guidelines for eligibility, which is 49% of the respondents in the survey you gave? My goal and the goal of this government is to ensure that those people who require access to medical card get it. It's a very sensitive, it's a very difficult one. We shouldn't have to hear the stories we hear on Liveline. We do hear the exceptions on Liveline, but it's not good enough. And there is a need to be very careful here. We're talking about people who require medical care and treatment here. But
Dr. Ray Wally wants to come in there, Gerry.
In regard to that, Gerry, a lot of these are discretionary cards. It has been stated that discretionary card never included medical illness. Well, this GP, who's 25 years in the system, has seen many of these cards given out on the medical illness because it made sense that this the medical card was given out to the patient because it was going to cost a lot more money to the state. Because remember, the state subsidises after €140 for medication. The state subsidises after a certain amount of time in hospital. So ultimately, the state was going to carry the bill for a lot of this in the first place. So I'm afraid it may be the criteria now that they're saying it was never given out in the medical illness. My experience as a long sort of in the two GP was medical illness was a factor besides income.
Gerry, that's why this government is committed to your healthcare change in terms of universal GP care, and that's why we're bringing in the under fives, where you have medicine close to people in communities being treated at the lowest level of complexities and at the lowest level of cost. And that's why this is a very important point. And I agree with Ray. It does make sense to have people in the loop as opposed to outside not taking care of themselves. And that's why the under five GP care is going to be a significant player in the future.
Just to stick with the medical card, Gerry, do you have the sense that Dr. James Riley is deeply uncomfortable with the fact that these targets have been imposed upon him by the Department of Public Expenditure?
Well, the Minister, first of all, set up the clinical review panel in terms of the reviewing of medical cards, which has been, I think, a major addition. Secondly, the Minister has asked the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform and the Department of Taoiseach, along with his own department, to validate the budget, which I think is important as well. And thirdly, this is a minister who's a reforming minister, who's a caring minister, who will deliver a very substantial and qualitative change to the health system. And he is, of course, concerned that people go on programmes like Joe Duffy and be forced into trauma and stress. People have enough stress and emotion in their life without having to endure this type of hardship. And that's why he's asked the HSC in to have a straight communication with the people involved to make it easy for people to renew their application and to be able to have a point of contact. So, you know, I mean, to say that this government is aloof and uncaring is unkind and untrue because, you know, there is a big ask in taking $2.5 billion out of it, and the people have made sacrifices and people are uncomfortable in doing that. But we've seen a 74% increase in medical cards since 2005, and we've 1.9 million people, 43% of our country, access to medical cards as we speak, and GP cards.
I want to bring in Roisin Shorthall quickly.
If we leave the clichés aside, the reality is that if the government is targeting savings of $149 million from medical cards, that is going to hurt large numbers of people by denying them access to basic health care. The reality is that there is a total incoherence within the Department of Health. The official policy is that they're going to expand access to primary care and GP services. In practice, what they're doing is denying more and more people that access. And on the other hand, in relation to health insurance, of course, the official policy is that we're moving towards a universal health insurance system. But, you know, again, the budgetary policy being completely incoherent, denying more people access to health insurance by making it less affordable. It just doesn't add up.
Mick Roughly wants to get in there.
It's interesting that some of the ministers have been sort of gloating that there haven't been that many protests against this budget and particularly the medical card. But the Age Action Ireland are calling for a protest outside the Dáil on Tuesday. Now, it'll be interesting to see, and not just about that issue, but about the whole direction that this budget has taken, which has taken money really off the old, the young and the women. That there's a whole raft of measures there. Some of them people haven't even noticed. Now, if the prescription, if that can become the lever by which the suppressed anger at the moment of people can emerge, and the government be told a message that we've taken enough, and I would encourage all people affected by this to show up on Tuesday.
Dr. Ray Wally.
In regard to general practice does want to actually take back stuff that should be attending hospital, patients who should be attending hospital, but you could only do that with appropriate resources. What we're talking about here is taking on an increased burden of workload with no resource transfer. At the moment in Ireland, 43% of the population have a medical card. The medical card is made up of the oldest, the sickest, which equivalent to 80% of the general practice workload. We have 2% of the healthcare budget in regard to that. 2% of the resources. In the UK, they have a tenth of the resources. So we are way below the resources. What is happening here, it is smoke and mirrors. What they're doing is transferring a burden of workload without the resource provision. Now, I'd also like to correct Mr. Bothermer and one remark he says, that you're going to the lowest part of the complex, lowest complexity. These people are actually the most complex, because in what we are getting in patients, we're dealing as the general practitioners with the cardiology issues, respiratory issues, neurology issues, whereas the neurologist deals with the neurology issues, the surgical deals with the surgery. We're dealing with all of that, plus the social issue. These are the most complex patients. It is a misrepresentation by the existing Minister for Health and Mr. Bothermer if he thinks these are not complex. They are the most complex patients. And as a result of that, you need to put the appropriate resourcing. Now, if you want the same standard of care, similar to what you want in Holland, similar to what you want in the UK, you have to put that resource in. Presently, it's 2% of the healthcare budget. In the UK, it's 10%.
I want to move quickly just to one of the other aspects of the budget, which was the decision to put a cap on the tax relief in respect of health insurance. Now, in his budget speech, the Finance Minister, Michael Noonan, said this would impact primarily on those with gold-plated health insurance policies. However, it appears the Revenue Commissioner has informed the Department of Finance that it would affect some 577,000 policyholders, and the health insurers themselves say it could be 8-9 out of 10 policyholders. Gerry Bothermer, you've had the health insurers in before the Oireachtas Health Committee on a number of occasions. You know the issues that are there in terms of spiralling premiums and people dropping out. Is this going to damage that? Is this going to add further to the acceleration of people leaving health insurance?
Well, you have a disparity of figures, Brian, between both sets of people here. Revenue estimated will affect 50% of people. The cost to the state, you know, here is very high. And what we must do here is, I think in the finance bill, we will see clarity brought to this issue. It is a matter of taxation. It is a matter of the state funding. I mean, it will save us 94 million in 2014 and 127 million in 2015. And what we must try and do here is to ensure that we do, and I disagree with other speakers there, is that this government is about accelerating a health reform programme, which we will see the first phase of UHI and money following the patient. And I think, you know, health insurance is going up. There is an obligation on the health insurers to reduce their costs too.
The Department of Finance make the point that I think that this year the money foregone in tax relief would be about the order of 500 million euro. But surely that reflects the fact that the price of health insurance has increased so much over the last number of years.
Well, let's put a figure out here, Brian, for you and your listeners. We've seen a decrease in the health insurance policyholders of around 170,000 people since 2011. Yet the cost of the relief to the state has increased by around 100 million euro in the same period. So is this because of disproportionate premium rises by the insurance industry? Is it because of the cost of them? So, you know, we do need to have a complete look at the whole insurance industry, because costs have increased, yet we see more daycare procedures being done. We see it changing in how hospitals operate. So, you know, there is a bigger debate to be had here.
I want to bring in Roisin Shortall and Ray Wally. But just to say that this is an issue that we are going to return to in the next few weeks. We're going to look at this in some more depth. But Roisin Shorthall, quickly.
Again, this is a complete misrepresentation of the facts of the situation. You know, Michael Noonan stood up on Tuesday and was extremely disingenuous in portraying this as something that only affects the upper levels of health insurance, gold-plated policies. The reality is, of course, that this is going to affect the majority of people that have private health insurance. And at the moment, there's 6,000 people leaving health insurance because it's so unaffordable at the moment. 6,000 per month. This, of course, is going to drive more people out. And far from getting the reforms that we were promised in the Department of Health, where we're moving towards an insurance-based universal health insurance system, what is happening now is that less and less people are in the system. It's less affordable. We were promised a white paper on all of this to chart the way forward, and we just haven't seen any of that reform.
Dr. Ray Wally, very quickly on this before we move to a break.
In regard to money follows the patient, there is actually no government document indicating that money will follow the patient from the hospital to general practice. The money follow the patient's document, Gerry, is in regard to the other way around. In regard to health insurance, it is a pressure valve. Many of the patients who came into me found the comments as gold-plated, as disingenuous. These are people on a B level, not the top level, and they found it disingenuous that they were referred to as gold-plated. It is a pressure valve, a safety valve to have access to insurance, and it will affect the public system.
Gerry Buttermore, a very last quick word from you.
The government is committed towards moving towards money following the patient and the introduction of UHI, and this is the GP under five, and I disagree with Roisin Shorthall. This government is about reform. The cliche of opposition is outdated. This is a government committed to reform, driving costs down, increasing the optimum that people will be able to achieve.
Okay, Gerry, can I just read some of the texts and emails? The government is moving successfully to universal healthcare where no one can afford healthcare. That's from Paddy in Drumcondra in Dublin. Gerry Buttermore is a decent politician. How can he stand over Riley's ineptitude? It's time for Riley to resign or be sacked. That's from Luke in Dunleary. There are still hundreds of wealthy over 70-year-olds who were never means-tested and have kept their medical cards, yet poorer people have lost theirs. It's unfair, from John in Cork. We're going to move on to the next discussion. I want to thank Dr. Ray Wally for joining us. Coming up after the short break, more on the budget fallout. And do the markets believe that Ireland is ready to go alone after the bailout? Stay with us. Welcome back. Gerry Buttermore, Roisin Shorthall and Mick Rafferty are still here with us. We're also joined by economist and Trinity College finance lecturer Dr. Konstantin Gurdiev, and joining us from London, Vincent Boland, he of the Lex column in the Financial Times. Good afternoon, Vincent. What did you make of the budget?
I thought it was a pretty comprehensive package. I think the main thing I noticed about it was obviously that they had decided not to go the whole distance on the sort of last of the austerity package. And I thought that was a pity in a way. It was an opportunity to get everything done and behind the government and behind the country, actually. And I think it may be a missed opportunity.
And in terms of the government, as you know, one of the key points made about this budget was this is, if you like, the staging post to exiting the bailout. Do you think that this budget will reassure markets that Ireland is ready to go it alone?
Yes, I think it will. I mean, obviously, the government's very insistent on that point. And I think that investors the international sort of community generally, you know, are happy enough that Ireland is ready to exit from the bailout and from the Troika and, you know, and sort of put its foot back in the market. But I think that it's a very difficult transition to make. And it's not simply a question of, you know, shutting down one and opening up another overnight. It needs to be handled very, very carefully. And, you know, while the government is clearly determined to do so, there's so many things on the outside that could affect it yet that it will need to be very careful and not talk the thing up too much, I think.
Dr. Konstantin Gurdiev, what did you make of the budget?
Well, I would agree with your previous speaker there. It's largely an imaginative budget. It's a bit boring in many ways. What we expected is a little bit more of a confidence-building exercise, a little bit more forward action in terms of the cuts, less of taxation. The budget mix is very similar to the past budgets, too much on taxation and indirect taxation side, too little in terms of structural cuts and structural reforms. In a sense, we've had a series of budgets now whereby the structural reforms were not really enacted. And we are looking now at a situation where going forward in, say, 2016, 2017 and onwards, parts of the cuts that we have seen so far to date will be reversed, some of them automatically under the Huntington Agreement. But outside of that, also, they will be reversed probably due to the political pressures. And that presents kind of questions about the future. The budget itself is predicated on a hope-filled kind of, if you want, mathematics, that growth is going to return and it's going to be relatively robust. Perhaps that's so. That's not the point of forecasting, really. It's a question of the risk, if you want, management exercise. And in proper risk management exercise, you would assume probably much more cautious scenarios than the ones which were assumed going forward in the budget itself. So, for example, the growth side of the equation was fairly similar, but a little bit more optimistic relative to what IMF is projecting, you know, and also the Central Bank of Ireland. On the other hand, there are much more optimistic projections as well in the market. So it's a balancing act. And the balancing act, I thought, was taken on the side of the political expediency and on the side of a little bit of a too much hope built into it.
Vincent, do you get the sense that across Europe there is an expectation that growth will resume into 2014 and that perhaps the government might get lucky?
Well, I think that there's a lot riding on growth returning very soon. I mean, we've seen, you know, some signs that the Eurozone economy, that the European economy generally is doing a bit better, and, you know, Germany, you know, seems to be doing a bit better. But it's all very tentative, I think. And, you know, next year, there's so much expected next year from, you know, from both by the Irish people and by the you know, all of Europe. You know, also in Spain, in Italy, in Germany, in Britain, the whole, you know, everybody has so much sort of hope invested in 2014 that I'm afraid that the likelihood that everybody's going to be disappointed is probably, you know, significant enough. And, you know, Europe cannot grow by itself. You know, China has to grow fast and America has to grow. And it's all, you know, it's all part of a sort of global picture. And, I, you know, I just think that 2014 needs to deliver, and if it doesn't, there's going to be a lot of disappointment.
Gerry Butler in Cork, what happens if we don't get the 2% growth next year?
Well, I suppose the key point here is that everything is predicated upon us leaving the bailout on December the 15th. We are seeing our economy creating 3,000 jobs a month as opposed to 7,000 we were losing per month. We have seen this budget continuing the correction of 2.5 billion, which leaves us with a deficit of 4.8 ahead of our 5.1% target. We have a 500 million euro stimulus plan. Events like what happened in the States last couple of weeks, 16 days, we had a shutdown of government. You know, other events across Europe do play a part, but we are also, you know, very much within our own hands to be able to emerge from the very darkest period of our economic as a country. And I think the important point here is that we have a minister and a government who are very much in charge, who are correcting excessive expenditure whilst at the same time creating jobs and boosting, you know, vast sectors of the economy.
But if the 2% growth doesn't materialise, there will be a huge hole in the numbers next year.
Well, you know, the minister has always made a point that, you know, everything that we do is about getting out of the bailout. It's about having necessary reserves available with the NTMA and so on to be able to ride out the storm. And we've done that with the sacrifice of the Irish people. And the Irish people have made a very significant and you know, it must be acknowledged that they've made a huge sacrifice. But this government is committed. The minister will be heading to Washington, Germany during the week as part of his, you know, negotiations and talking to world leaders about our country continuing our growth and the pattern of growth that we've had. And I think it's important to realise that this is a government who are not going to return to the old ways of throwing money at everything.
Mick Rafferty, is this high finance just way above the kind of people that you represent in community activity?
No. I think people would know that if you have 100 quid coming in and you're spending 130, you've got to do something. You know, you're going to go broke. But the manner in which you bridge the gap is the issue. Now, this is a mean, stingy budget, which is going to have social consequences, which will only unfold. I mean, there was a letter in the Times during the week, and it says, "So Minister Brendan Howlin and Noonan have created a situation where an elderly lady can't phone the guard or press her panic button due to poverty when a 25-year-old youth burgles a home due to poverty." Now, I don't necessarily agree with that because I don't necessarily see a link between poverty and crime. But what's not being looked at is the social consequences of the manner in which we're getting out of this bailout and which we're obeying the paymasters in Europe. And, you know, it's a sort of illusion that if we get out of the bailout, somehow or other we can begin to you know, the we'd still be in debt. We'll still have to go to the banks, and we'll still have, if that growth doesn't occur, policies of austerity. So, I mean, what I'm saying is that there is an alternative budget that could have been done, and that would have been about taxing the rich and, in fact, readjusting a lot of the income of the political class. I mean, I can't understand how somebody on 200 and something thousand a year can justify cutting €40 off a young under 25 person. It doesn't make sense. It makes sense in their terms, but not socially or ethically.
Well, clearly it's very important that we regain our economic sovereignty. But the question is, you know, at what cost and who pays? Now, Vincent Boland is talking about the problem with Ireland's stock market being hollowed out, as he describes it. But the reality is that the domestic economy has been hollowed out as well as a result of the kind of austerity policies that this government has pursued, in terms of taking money out of people's pockets and therefore reducing spending power. And that has a clear knock-on effect in relation to the domestic economy and job losses. And we have to remember, you know, there are some 1 million people working in the domestic economy in small and medium enterprises, and that needs much greater support. But the other point is that the social infrastructure has been hollowed out either, and Mick would be very conscious of this, in disadvantaged communities where the supports that had previously been there to try and compensate for the disadvantage, whether it's in education or in health or in general, kind of through the drugs task forces and so on, a lot of that social infrastructure is being hollowed out as well.
Something like 40% of community projects have disappeared in the 3 and 4 years.
That's right. And obviously the austerity cuts have a much greater impact on people who depend on public services.
Well, if you take areas where unemployment is high and there's a high dependency on social welfare, almost every penny that comes into that area is spent on the local economy. Now, with all these reductions going on, in some cases, families are going to be down perhaps by 50% of their total income. If you take all of the social welfare cuts in you know, add them all up.
In total.
But all of that is going to leave the local economy, which is going to cause, it's going to depress these local areas. And this is creating further inequalities.
I want to come back to Constantine Gordiev and Vincent Boland. One of the points, Constantine, that Michael Noonan has made is that, and Jerry Butmer made reference to it there, he's off to Washington, is that he's now attempting to negotiate whether or not the state needs some kind of safety net in the post-bailout situation. He's made the point that the National Treasury Management Agency has already pre-funded, I think, some €25 billion for the next year or so. Do we actually need an additional safety net?
We need to have some sort of a safety net just in case, as a precautionary measures. Exiting the bailout of the magnitude that we're exiting is very important, that we transition into the market smoothly. And this market pricing, I think, would reflect as well. So in other words, it would reflect as well if we would to take proper risk management approach to it and have some secured post-bailout funding. The reason for it is very important. Remember, we were talking here about small programs which cost not a lot to the exchequer, and yet we're cutting them left, right and center. And even 10 basis points, something like 10% of a 1% in terms of the yields on the bonds would be significant improvement for our fiscal position. So we have to take all of the measures possible in terms of securing that. Exiting bailout itself, by the way, is a misnomer. We're not going to regain any sort of independence. We're under six-pack and two-pack legislation. We're under the fiscal compact, and all of that means that everything that the government is going to be doing into perpetuity is going to be under scrutiny of the EU. We're losing out of a troika, probably the most vociferous advocate of our own actually objectives, the IMF. The irony has it that our European partners are imposing even more pain on us and are willing to continue doing so. Let me just very quickly go back to something that everybody mentioned, Mick mentioned, Roisin, everybody really, and the whole issue of the growth and the growth return, domestic growth versus anything else. In the 1990s, the European economy was growing very robustly, and yet the Belgian economy, which was saddled with about 100% debt-to-GDP ratio on the government side, was not growing at all when you strip out the Brussels transfers. Nothing tells us that the return to growth in Europe or in the United States or around the world is going to boost the Irish growth rates beyond where they are currently. Nothing, absolutely. We have an economy which is saddled with debt all across the board, and no government official, certainly not in the budget, is talking about what to do with the household debt, what to do with the corporate debts, companies' debts, and how to deal with any of that. They're extracting money out of private economy. Our investment rates are the lowest or second lowest in Europe. Our saving rates are the fourth or fifth lowest in Europe.
Vincent Boland, Vincent Boland, the level of our debt, how is that perceived from where you're sitting in London? Are we now reaching a point where there might be a view taken by markets that we are getting close to debt sustainability? Or take the point that Dr. Konstantin Gurdjieff has made there, that the weight of the debt is still far too burdensome.
Oh, I think that's true. I agree entirely with Konstantin on the point of the debt. I mean, 123% debt to GDP ratio is definitely unsustainable. And of course, it's going to fall next year, but it will only fall if there is, you know, robust economic growth and there is a continued sort of sense on spending at home. But this is a big problem across Europe. Is that the bailouts are coming to an end and the debt sustainability question has not been addressed. I think that the question for Ireland in the longer term is what happens to the legacy bank debt. That is the big unanswered question for Ireland. And I think that that issue cannot go away and has not gone away. And, you know, until that question of legacy bank debt is fully addressed, the question of Irish debt sustainability will not be answered.
Gerry Buttermer in Cork. Over recent days, we've seen where the German finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, has made the point again that he sees difficulties in the new ESM funding mechanism engaging in the direct recapitalisation of banks and particularly retrospective recapitalisation of banks. Now, Michael Noonan says his comments have to, Wolfgang Schäuble's comments have to be seen in the context of the negotiations of a new government in Germany. But there must surely be some concern in government circles that this final leg of the negotiations on our debt, and there's some 30 billion euro at issue here, that this could run into serious difficulties depending on the shape of the next German government.
Yeah, well, Michael Noonan is correct in saying that. I mean, this is part of a hardball game in Germany, and Michael Noonan has shown and demonstrated his ability within Europe, where he stood up to our European counterparts by renegotiating our deal. And if I could just make the point that in the context of what Mick and Roisin are saying, this government has unfurled 14 million of an increase in places available to young people to get them out of poverty. And, are we seriously saying that we want to see people migrating from school to welfare and to stay there? I spent 17 years in the classroom, and I can tell you, you can't beat having a job, and you can't beat having the sense of hope that a job gives and further education. And that's why this government has seen the youth guarantee, which will again provide further training. Job, which has been a success, the pathways to work, the reform of a welfare system will all help to change the mindset and the cultural attitudes regarding work and a job. And again, it's about targeting young people to get them out of unemployment. And yes, we've seen a reduction in unemployment, and it is too high and it remains stubbornly high. But I mean, are we seriously saying that the old, outdated model of how we develop and build community continues to be the way to go forward? I spent 20-odd years working in communities myself, and I understand the importance of community, and I know the importance of schemes and supports. But we must look at the model and how we can move away from the old, outdated models in delivery of community. And I think in this government's case, the issue of the youth is one of absolute importance, and that's why you've seen a change. But this government is about getting people into jobs and creating employment and giving them that sense of hope that a job and education brings. And
I want to go back to Vincent Boland for a brief moment. Vincent, you watch international affairs as well, and you play a close eye on what's happening in Europe particularly. How do you read the way it's shaping up in Germany and perhaps the prospects for recapitalisation of the Irish banks, which would be retrospective recapitalisation? And there are some, I think it's some 30 billion euro is at stake here, the money that was put into the main pillar bank, so-called.
That's right. I mean, the big question, really, Brian, that the Eurozone has not addressed throughout this crisis is the bank problem. At its heart and at its core, and fundamentally, this whole crisis is a sort of debt/bank problem. And until the banking question is addressed, and I include Ireland in that, because the question of retrospective recapitalization must, I think, be at least on the table as far as Eurozone policy.
I think our own government believes it is on the table, but I don't know, would you share their optimism?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that there are many perceptions of this out there. It's on the table today, it's not on the table tomorrow. I mean, I think that Wolfgang Schäuble keeps the ball in the air all the time. And I think that until it is on the table, definitely, and all the parties around the table talking about it, then it's only then that it can be addressed properly. But the question of bank debt and legacy bank debt and bank recapitalisation is the big question that Eurozone policymakers have not addressed. And until they do so, this crisis is not over.
Very quickly, Dr. Constantine Gordia, how critical is the retrospective bank recapitalisation for our debt sustainability?
Let's not overplay this. We're talking about 30 billion in valuations which are hope-filled valuations. So we are really talking about the actual accountancy-wise, what the Irish accounts show is between 11 and 9 billion really amount. So it's not that critical. It is very important for us to get it. But let me correct very quickly the record here. This is not just Germany who is saying it. This is not German politics alone. Let us remember that Finland, Austria, and Netherlands co-signed with Germany a statement that they do not want to see retroactive recapitalization of banks anywhere in the Eurozone. That was about a year and a half ago. Mario Draghi, about 2 weeks ago, went on a record saying he does not believe ESM should have any right to recapitalize the banks whatsoever, which pushes the entire agenda off the table. I mean, this is not by far just SPD, CDU, CSU type of the negotiations in Germany.
Okay. We're getting an awful lot of calls and texts in relation to the medical card. We won't be able to deal any more with that issue. I want to thank Vincent Boland for joining us from London. After this short break, we'll be back with more on the pensions levy, and Fianna Fáil spokesman on finance, Michael McGraw, will be joining us then. You're with Saturday with Brian Dowling. Now, last night in Limerick, the Minister for Finance, Michael Noonan, suggested the reason why the pension levy was kept in this budget was because the pension industry had failed to deliver their side of a deal. The exact nature of this deal is not quite clear, but it appears to relate to a revenue expectation that the government had that money would come into the coffers as a result of limiting tax-free pension contributions, and that has not yet materialised. Michael McGraw, the Fianna Fáil spokesman on finance, is with us in Cork as well. Michael McGraw, what do you make of all this?
Good afternoon, Brian. Well, the first point I would make, Brian, is that the commitment to abolish the pension levy in 2014 was an unconditional commitment. In other words, that promise was not made on the basis of any deal with the pensions industry. When it was imposed back in 2011 as part of the jobs initiative, the minister stated clearly then on several subsequent occasions and again in the budget last year that the levy would end in 2014. He announced a U-turn on that decision last Tuesday in the budget, and the levy is actually going up by a quarter now in 2014, and then is falling back down to 0.15% in 2015. So next year, for example, the minister will now be taking up to €650 million out of private pension savings, and many of those schemes, as we know, are already experiencing very significant deficits. My sense of what the minister was referring to in Limerick last night relates to an announcement made in last year's budget. You will recall, he pre-announced that from the 1st of January 2014, that you would only get tax relief on contributions into pension schemes that delivered a maximum pension of €60,000, and he announced then that that would save about €250 million in 2014. That seems to have run into some difficulty.
Michael, I just want to go to Jerry Buttermer.
Sure.
Jerry Buttermer, is this another potential trouble point for the government?
No, I don't think so. I think the minister made it quite clear in his budget statement that the money was being funded to create jobs. There's two sides to the story. The minister invited in the pensions industry, and I know that they will come in and engage with Michael Noonan, and I would very much invite them and welcome them to come in and talk to him. The minister is very open to it. There's no row, there's no dispute. This is, I think, an issue that needs to be just, you know, tapered down. This is about creating jobs, about making sure that people get back to work. We've seen a government in the stimulus in the budget about creating jobs. You've got money
from
the banks.
But there is an issue for many people that it does amount to effectively taking money from people's pension funds over a period of time, albeit it will fall down to a rate of 0.1% in 2 years' time.
Yeah, and it will in 2015 go back to that, as you said. But I mean, you know, we are critting the nation's finances. We have put a stimulus package in place. You know, we've seen Ryanair already, committed to bringing an extra 1 million passengers into the country. So you've seen the 9% VAT retained. Something has to pay for it. It's unfortunate we have to do this, but it's about critting the finances of the country.
Roisin Shorthall, what do you make of this?
I think this is a very serious issue. I saw Michael Noonan on the news last night, and he seemed to let the cat out of the bag. He unwittingly disclosed that he was trying to do some kind of secret deal with the pensions industry. Now, this is taxpayers' money we're talking about. You know, tax relief on pensions costs about €2.5 billion every year. 80% of that goes to the top 20% of earners. It's a very unfair system. And we were promised reform in this whole area. Now, it seems that the minister has been wheeling and dealing with a major vested interest in the whole area of pensions, with the industry itself. And that simply is not good enough. He implied by what he said that he was increasing the levy as a way of somehow punishing the industry. But of course, we know that this punishes pensioners. He's taking €2 billion out of the pockets of pensioners, private sector pensioners. Many
well, I think
of
it's
whom,
a much smaller amount than that, Roisin.
No, overall, during the course of the levy, that's the amount that's been taken out. And now he's increasing
it. It'll be well over
that.
€2 billion
from,
in the end.
Far from removing it, he's increasing it. And I would call on Michael Noonan to make a full public statement on this to explain exactly what he's doing.
There
in
is no
role, Roisin.
There is no
relief.
Issue here at all. And you're using cliches.
But I want to bring in Mick Rafferty.
No, just one of the issues is the whole issue of transparency and you know, proof in certain things and looking at the effects of them. Just while you were chatting there, Roisin, about pensions, I was thinking about the woman in Sheriff Street or John McDermott Street who this week was told that there'd be no grant to bury her. You know, I mean, I think that's it's the stinginess of this budget.
Mick, that's a very silly comment, Mick, in fairness. Because, I mean, this government has a
way in which they're coming
that's a very
up with
silly
these
comment.
Cuts.
Can I come in there, Brian?
Michael McGrath, where is this going politically? Well, what's your next move on this?
Well, you know, the point here is Gerry says that there isn't any row, but the minister last night justified a very significant U-turn in government policy when he already had said the pension levy would end in 2014. Says that that is not now going to be the case because, in his own words, the pensions industry did not live up to their side of the bargain. Now, what was the bargain is the question. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the bargain was. I'm speculating it is about the restriction of relief on pensions.
Very, very quickly, Michael, I want to go very quickly. The last word to Gerry Buttermer, but very quickly.
There is no row. There is no dispute. The pension industry will meet with the minister. The government's about creating a €500 million stimulus package to get jobs back to the country. That's the most important element of this budget.
That's our lot for today. Thanks to all our guests and thank you for joining us.